How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
Welcome to Climate One, a conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. To understand any of them, you have to understand them all. I'm Greg Dalton. Today we're discussing a new means of personal mobility. A few decades ago, if you didn't have a car and there wasn't a bus nearby, you might have had to stick your thumb out on the side of the road. Today you can employ your fingers by opening a smartphone app and finding a ride across town or across the country. If you want to drive, you can do that too, in a car owned by a company or a neighbor. Over the next hour, we'll discuss the transportation piece of the sharing economy with our live audience here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. We're pleased to have with us four people who are at the forefront of these innovations. Rick Hutchinson is CEO of City CarShare. Sunil Paul is CEO of Sidecar, a ride-sharing company in San Francisco and a handful of other cities. We also have with us Susan Shaheen, co-director of the Transportation and Sustainability Research Center at UC Berkeley. And we also have Kristen Sverchek, the head of public policy at Lyft and Zimride. Please welcome them to Climate One. I'd like to start briefly by asking you how you kind of got into this part of the sharing economy and car sharing. And Susan Shaheen, you've been doing this a very long time. Tell us briefly how you got into this new area quite some time ago.
Mm-hmm. So I've been researching car sharing and shared use vehicle systems for about 17 years, which is seems like a really long time. And I thought it made tremendous sense after I saw a presentation about car sharing systems by Michael Glotsch-Richter, who came over from the city of Bremen on a German Marshall Fellowship. He lectured at University of California, Davis. I heard his lecture, and I said, aha, this is my dissertation topic. And I was challenged by my dissertation committee, who said, there is no way Americans will give up their cars. And I thought there might be a chance, and I never looked back.
So you wanted to prove your dissertation committee wrong. Okay.
Yes.
Sunil Paul, you were an investor, and then you had a previous incarnation. I believe it was it Spride. Was that was it another company? So tell us how you got into the sharing economy and the ride sharing.
Well, actually, my story begins way back in 1997. Believe it or not, I had just moved to San Francisco. Me and my wife had one car between us. And one day, as I was waiting to be picked up, I had a little epiphany. But before that, I had a little idea, which was, I need to get another car. But the little epiphany was, someday my phone's going to know where I am. And all these people driving by, all their phones are going to know where they are. And I started thinking, wow, someday we're going to rethink transportation around this idea. It led me to kind of work through those ideas. I got a patent in 2002. I ran into the founders of City CarShare. I'm like, oh, okay, here's another example of information technology, rethinking transportation. Was on the board of City CarShare for several years. Got involved in, taught Singularity University, the Get Around students, or the students of mine went and created Get Around. Spride is a company that we tried incubating and decided not to pursue. Also got a law passed here in California that enables peer-to-peer car sharing, AB 1871. So my interest in this category has been around for a long time. I think that ride sharing, which is what Sidecar does, is an opportunity to really expand this opportunity very, very rapidly and aggressively around the world.
Excellent. And Rick, let's ask you how you got into this space. You're a nonprofit. How did you get into this space of ride sharing, car sharing?
Well, City CarShare was started by a couple of local activists back in the late 90s, and they actually put cars on the road here in 2001. So we're about 12 years old. I'm a reformed banker, and I made my way out here, did a couple of startups, and then ran into people like Sunil, who were doing some pretty amazing things in the space of the environmental space, but also around innovation and technology. So City Car Share had lost its executive director, and after a little dance, decided to join in, and the rest is history. It's been 7 years.
And we'll get into a little bit more about car sharing, ride sharing, et cetera, in this part of the sharing economy. Kristen Sverchek, how did you come to the space of ride sharing and car sharing?
Yeah, so I initially was outside counsel to a number of the kind of high-flying collaborative consumption companies, TaskRabbit and Zimride being among them, also represented investors and companies like Wheels. Had started working with Zimride back in 2010. Zimride and Lyft are one and the same. And grew closer and closer with the founders, really saw the vision and what they were doing over the last couple of years. Came on board full-time about 3 months ago to head up legal and public policy matters.
Great. All right, so let's get some of the basic terms here and sort of set the table. Susan Shaheen, you've been studying this a long time. Can you kind of outline for us car sharing, ride sharing, some of the key terms, and then we can dive into how they're changing the way people get around the world?
Mm-hmm. So the definition of what we call classic car sharing is fairly simple. It's the shared use of a vehicle fleet.
We need to put your mic on. Thanks.
The shared use of a vehicle fleet by a group of members. They frequently pay an annual fee, a monthly fee, and typically pay by the hour and, in some cases, by mileage, like in the city car share case. There's a couple new flavors of car sharing that you've heard mentioned, and one is the peer-to-peer car sharing concept. And that's the idea of people putting their own personal vehicles into these car sharing fleets. And we were also seeing a new form called one-way. And companies like Car2Go are out there. That's a Daimler product. And BMW DriveNow is also operating here in the city. And that's a one-way model. So in Rick's model, which is a more classic car sharing model, individuals go into and out of the same location for their access to the vehicle. With one way, you actually can take the vehicle from one location to another. So there's a lot of tremendous innovation happening in the car sharing space right now. There's a lot of confusion about definitions and impacts, and it's causing some flurry of activity here, actually in San Francisco. And in terms of ride sharing, there's a couple different flavors of that. Starts with the most simple, which is a fam pool, so a family actually sharing a vehicle and taking children to and from school, maybe with neighbors. And it also moves into more of a classic carpooling situation where people are sharing a vehicle that they carpool in for work trips or more regular trips. There's longer distance carpooling trips. And what we're starting to see a tremendous amount of innovation in, that which is represented by Sidecar and Lyft, my colleagues here, is this idea of real-time ride sharing. So very dynamic, very instant. So what we're seeing, in my opinion, is the growth and development of the shared use mobility space. And we don't exactly know how it's going to shake out. We've got a lot of work ahead, particularly in the public policy arena.
So the concepts have been around a long time. Taxis, super shuttle, right? I mean, that's sort of, you go into the airport, share in a van, that sort of thing. So why is this all happening now? Is it the technology? Is it hard economic times that's kind of making people more cost conscious? Sunil, what's sort of driving it?
I think there's three things that have changed. I actually looked at doing something like this in 99 and decided not to for three reasons, all of which have changed. One, the technology was not ready. So the smartphone platforms and having them be open, there actually have been smartphones for a very long time. What's changed is that you can now have access to them without having to convince some big, huge company, the telecom carrier, to cooperate with you. You can publish it to the iTunes store, you can publish it to the Android store, and more are coming. The second is that there's interest on the part of everyday people in new forms of transportation. I mean, I think this is we have more willingness to experiment with transportation right now than at any time since before World War II. Mm-hmm. Since that time, we pretty much accepted the automobile as the way it's going to be. It was the dominant technology of our era.
And owning that automobile.
Yeah, that's right. A car that you own. For the first time, because of this technology, because of things like climate change, things like energy security. There is a willingness to try new things, and technology as well, things like electric vehicles, etc. And then the third thing is there's political will to try new things. For the same reasons, climate change and energy security, there is a political will to experiment. I mean, a quick anecdote, when I was advocating for AB 1871, I was sent into a Republican's office because, probably shouldn't say publicly all the reasons why I was sent in, but...
This was a law to change the way insurance is handled? That was?
Okay. Yes. And the insurance companies could have easily killed this bill, I was told, with a single phone call. And I was told also that these Republicans were, very amenable to the interests of the insurance companies. So I went in, I met with a staffer, and I was prepared for all my arguments. First words out of her mouth were, "This is the wave of the future. The insurance companies need to figure it out and get on board." To me, that was an indication of, okay, there is a willingness to try new things in transportation. There is a willingness to accept that, look, the smartphone and information technology is the wave of the future. We are going to reorganize our entire society around this stuff, and transportation is just one of those things. We've already done it with media and shopping and all manner of things. Transportation is merely the next big category to be transformed.
One person at Google Ventures said that in 5 years, your car will be your smartphone. What does that mean? I mean, does that mean self-driving cars? Does that mean more displays in the car? What does that mean?
I know what it means for us. When we say that, we are talking about today. When you want to do anything in modern life, whether you want to get food from the grocery store, you want to get to work and earn income, you want to go out on a date, everything is mediated by the automobile. And now, everything's going to be mediated by your smartphone. You are going to be able to get the mobility you need to, whether it's going grocery shopping or going out on a date or getting to work, all of that is going to be possible through your smartphone.
Fascinating. Let's talk about the size of this market. Do we know how big this market is right now? I mean, of personal mobility or car sharing, there's lots of companies. They're pretty small. Zipcar is one of the large ones. Do we know how big it is?
Yes. This is what I do. I track these numbers for the industry. That's why Rick looked at me. So, interesting news. I have not shared this with the public or the media yet. We just did our data collection for January of 2013, and North America has surpassed the million mark for car-sharing members. That includes Mexico, which is quite small, one program, Canada, and the U.S. The U.S. is around 800,000 members, or about 820,000 members.
So a million people are a member of, you said car or ride-sharing?
Car-sharing.
Car-sharing, okay. So that's a Zipcar, City Car Share.
Mm-hmm. And that's tremendous growth, right, from...
It has been growing. Has been growing. And really, since we've started our tracking efforts in the late 90s, we have really never seen a decline. We've seen ongoing growth. I do think that this product, though, this service, could scale much bigger than what we see today. And one of the concerns I have is, how do we look at this from a public policy standpoint to make it more possible to grow those numbers even bigger? You know, I'm very interested in the question of scalability now, where I used to be very interested in the question of impacts. How does this impact society and the environment? Now I'm also really moving into scale.
Well, and who are those people? Who are those million people? Are they all people who live in urban area, basically people under 40 who live in urban areas?
Those tend to be some of the common demographics. And I think there's a chance and an opportunity to grow much beyond that through innovations in the business models and changes in the overall approach. And I think everybody here on this panel represents that change.
And then what are the impacts of that change on existing businesses, car companies? We talked a little bit about insurance companies. Are the car companies going to sell fewer cars?
They could sell more cars if they put them into car sharing systems. And so we see a number of automakers who are very interested in actually providing these services. As I mentioned, Daimler is putting smart vehicles out there, and BMW is putting electric vehicles out there. So they could actually be a service provider as well as a vehicle provider. But, you know, folks like Rick need to have cars in his fleet. So there's an opportunity for them to develop a new core competency in their business called mobility services. Ultimately, there may be an impact in the total size of vehicles available, but, you know, we're looking at a changing world where people are moving more into urban areas, so there's limited space. And we're also facing energy issues and climate change issues that are also going to impact the future. So I think the role of the automobiles is changing, as well as the role of the car rental.
Bill Ford, the chairman of Ford Motor Company, was here recently, last year or so, perhaps a year before, and said car sharing is going to happen whether we like it or not, so we might as well be part of it. Sunil Paul, I mean, were you concerned about carbon? Is this ultimately going to reduce vehicle miles traveled, the number of cars out there, or is this just going to be growing, people going to be moving around more because it's easier to do?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think that there is, there is this potential paradox of as you make things more efficient, people tend to use them more. I do think that in the case of what we're doing, specifically with ride sharing, there's an opportunity to reduce emissions and reduce congestion. And it has to do with the way that we do it. Passengers must enter their destination, and drivers can see what that destination is. So we like to say the good of the nation requires destination. And that is basically conveying that if you can actually make the ride shared, then you can have reductions in emissions, you can have reductions in congestion. But if you can't have that kind of sharing, then you're not going to get those benefits.
So is this someone who's commuting from San Francisco to the East Bay? Or is this like a daily commute scenario? Is that what the typical use case is for someone who's going down the 101 and they want to get in the carpool lane and that sort of thing? So
we've got a number of different people. So we've created a platform that allows people to indicate, here's where I am, or here's where I want to go, and for drivers to be able to see that where that pickup point and destination is, and if that's a convenient trip for them, they'll accept it. So there's a guy we have in our system named Nick, who works in Mountain View. He lives in the city. He turns on the app in the morning. He looks for somebody going south. He picks him up, drops him off along the way, and continues onto his job. So that's one use case. There are other times when people are just turning it on to get out of the house and give rides to people just because they like meeting people, and it's a way to make a little extra money to offset their car costs.
Kristen Svercek, is that also a motivation for Lyft, which has those distinctive pink mustaches on the
pink
front?
Pink fuzzy car stashes.
Car stashes, is that what they're called? Is it the extra money that's is a big motivator?
I think there's a number of motivators. One of them certainly is the opportunity to make a little extra, as Sunil said, to offset your car costs. I think people also believe in the long-term vision of the company, which would be to have a net effect in reducing vehicle miles traveled and greenhouse gas and emission reduction as well.
But how does that really work? So if I hop in Lyft, and that car might have otherwise been sitting in the garage, I might have taken a taxi. The taxi's still out there driving around. So it's possible that this could actually increase greenhouse gases, more cars buzzing around. Rather than let my car sit in the garage, I'm going to go drive it and make some money.
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is actually something we've talked a lot about with Susan in the past. I believe initially with car sharing, there was a similar problem. When you had these vehicles available to people who maybe otherwise did not have a vehicle available, you were initially putting more cars on the road. But in the long term, once you reached a critical mass, you were having an overall positive net effect. And that would be our long-term vision as well.
Is that true? Is that what happened, Susan?
Yeah. A lot of times the early adopters of car sharing systems in a city are people who never had access to a car. So it's not surprising then to see an increase in vehicle miles traveled. But where the real gain and opportunity is for reduction in vehicle miles traveled is to actually get people to sell cars or to postpone car purchases. And one of our recent studies, which included City Car Share as well as all of the major car sharing companies, revealed that one car sharing vehicle takes 9 to 13 vehicles off the road and actually causes people to sell 4 to 6 vehicles of that 9 to 13. This is where we see from the metrics the data having a net effect, where some people are actually from zero car households, but the total net effect is actually positive towards the environment. This recent study showed approximately a 43% reduction in CO2 emissions as a result of those postponed as well as actual car purchases.
Rick Hutchinson, you also have some data on City Car Share and its impact and what it displaces in terms of carbon and vehicles miles traveled.
Right. So in the Bay Area, we're basically ground central here for car sharing, ride sharing, peer-to-peer car sharing. There are more companies here in the Bay Area offering services that allow people not to have to own a car, or at least to get rid of a car. For City Car Share, we've been experiencing that for years. In fact, about two-thirds of our members say that they either sold a car or delayed buying a car once they join us. A study done by Robert Severo back in the early 2000s, finished in 2006, is basically the only longitudinal mm-hmm. study that I know of, unless you know something else.
Yep.
And it showed cars taken off the road. It showed that a greener ride, meaning greener cars, can have a material impact on reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. City Car Share last year, and this is based on the Severo report and on work that Susan Shaheen has done, as well as Nelson Nygaard. We saved about 80 million pounds of CO2 emissions. Every day, 80,000 fewer miles are driven on Bay Area roads due to City Car Share members. You asked the question earlier about growth. There's been tremendous growth. When I joined in 2005, I had number 3205, actually. Last year, we issued number 40,000. So there's been tremendous growth in car sharing. Every single one of those members is likely to have gotten rid of a car, not buying a car, or is thinking about getting rid of another car. So therefore, you have not only reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, but in all of the CO2 that is released in actually the production of those vehicles that would have been purchased.
And you claim that your nonprofit car sharing service is actually greener than for-profit car sharing services. How?
Well, I don't claim it. I'm using some study information that came out of a Susan Shaheen study that showed that this is back in 2008, that showed that nonprofit car sharing organizations do save more greenhouse gas emissions than for-profits. Now, what's the reason for that? I think there's several reasons for it, and the main one from City Car Share's point of view is that we just have the greenest fleet in the industry. 45% of our cars are hybrids, plug-in electric vehicles or electric vehicles. When we look at the just based on EPA standards, that our fleet is about 35 to 40% more fuel and emission efficient than the standard car on the road today.
I will say, as a former City Car Share member, that I drove around in smaller cars that I probably wouldn't buy those cars, but yeah, drive around in them. So, Susan Shaheen, is that true that for-profit companies don't want to buy the greenest cars because it doesn't pencil out? They're looking to maximize their profit. Is that?
What I would say is that the data showed that both for-profits and nonprofits had a net negative effect of reducing CO2 emissions, or a positive effect for the environment. And we did see that this effect was higher for the nonprofits. I have another hypothesis in addition to the dynamics of the fleet, and Zipcar and other organizations that are in the for-profit realm also have clean cars. This is an explanatory variable, but I also think the pricing of how City Car Share prices has an impact, because they actually do charge by mile, and I think that has an impact on the total number of miles driven by a City Car Share vehicle, where that is contained more inside of the pricing of a for-profit company. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah, it costs more to go certain distances. But let's ask Kristen Svercek that for relay rides and some of these other models, Lyft, where people are using their own car, they may not be the cleanest new hybrid, et cetera. They might be that, just judging by some of the pink mustaches I've seen around town. Is there an incentive to be clean and green in the Lyft model?
As far as not with respect to the way that City Car Share is doing it, but I think that what's clean and green about it is that you have less single-occupant vehicles on the road. So hopefully less vehicles total, more people using their vehicles in an efficient way. So even if you're not driving a Prius, you maybe are taking another car off the road.
I read a statistic that 80% of the car seat miles in this country are empty, which
That's
kind
right.
of makes sense. You think about it, 20% five-passenger car. Most cars out there have, during rush hour, have. So we're talking about a pretty big cultural change here for all those people who are used to listening to NPR, we love them, sports radio or other things, and picking up a stranger and like, do I really want to talk to you all the way to San Jose? Really? I mean, I'm just curious in how this is working culturally to all of a sudden ride with strangers and make that kind of commitment.
Mm-hmm. I think it's working remarkably well. Because I think there's this whole culture that I'm old enough to remember Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And there is one of the things that surprised me about Sidecar is that we put all these safety measures into place and people have taken to it because the background check of the driver, the photo of the driver, the rating systems, the all of these systems have, I think, built confidence that this is a safe system, enough so that when we surveyed Sidecar users, 71% think that it's safer, they feel safer, in a ride that they match through Sidecar than in a taxi. So, and that's in, and we've only been around for even less than a year of offering this matching service.
As someone who recently took my first thrilling ride in Uber, which is another company that's kind of a real-time dynamic, basically displacing a taxi, I like the fact that I can see the guy's face before he picks me up, and then I have his information afterwards. I'm thinking that probably moderates that driver's, and I get to check one or five stars. That has a moderating effect on that person's behavior. Mm-hmm. Yakking on the cell phone, driving kind of crazy. So I think trust seems to be a big part of this. Confident use confidence. Mm-hmm. Let's say trust in terms of or accountability in both directions to making this work.
We have this new model of trust that's now possible, and it's because of social media broadly. Right. Just the ability for feedback. Like basically, there was very little accountability before. Casual carpool here in the Bay Area transports about 5,000 people a day, with really no accountability for who that driver is.
That's where you wait in line on the side of the road, car pulls up, you hop in, you don't know who they are, you're just hoping to,
That's right, and it's similar to slug lines in D.C. and casual carpool in San Diego. So we really took that model and said, gee, can we take that and make it possible to work across the entire Bay Area and around the entire country? And the answer is yes, it's working, and it's spreading very rapidly.
And it's spreading rapidly. That's also causing some resistance from established industries and regulators. So let's talk about the yellow cabs. Who's being disrupted by this innovation? You want to have a conversation, get a cab driver to talk about Uber or some of these things, and you'll get an earful. So let's talk about sort of the incumbent defending their territory, how that's playing out.
Well, this is... it is...
A
battle that happens a lot, which is the industries that see new innovation want to resist it, and they use every means possible that they can. I think another example of this is what happened with voice over IP. Things like Skype offer this amazing service, amazing advantage for consumers, and the telcos, AT&T and all the rest, really resisted it, and they used organizations like the PUC to help resist that change. I think a similar dynamic is at work right now, where we've got objections by, the objections that are made against us and Lyft and Uber don't come from the public. They come from, people who have a lot to lose by having innovation happen in the marketplace.
And that's been pricey for you. You've been fined, what, $20,000? I read one figure that the regulatory issues in California have cost you $500,000 fighting some of the fines.
Yeah, the fines. So here's, I mean, just so to recap, the California regulators, PUC, have sent cease and desist notices to us, Uber, Lyft, and Tick and Go, fined three of us. And while there are those fines out there, to be honest, what's very expensive, and you know we haven't paid these fines, what's really expensive is simply engaging with regulators. I mean, we are a startup.
But lawyers
we
are expensive.
Lawyers, just the bandwidth of mm-hmm. having to pay attention to it, that is the expensive part. And we are innovators. We are looking for new ways to make these systems better and really transform transportation. And here's a, you know, we estimate about $500,000 that have gone towards these regulatory engagements.
And what's their beef? That you're not regulated? That you're, what's the problem?
Well, I think the
you don't have a license to do what you're doing.
The PUC basically sent us a note saying that we should stop operating because we don't have a license for what they refer to as a charter party carrier, which is kind of a regulatory code thing for the same as a limo company. And, you know, we sent a response saying there's nothing to cease and desist. We don't have any cars. We don't have any drivers. I mean, we are an information provider. We provide matching up of riders and drivers. And so I think there's been a fundamental, this is a new medium, and this new medium needs new rules. That viewpoint is one that I think regulators in the beginning don't understand. We've seen the same thing in Philadelphia, in Austin, and undoubtedly.
In Austin, they're trying to make it illegal. In Philadelphia, they did a sting operation on your company.
Yes. So in Philadelphia, weekend before last, there was a sting operation where it wasn't against, well, I guess from their perspective, it was against our company, but they impounded the vehicles of three drivers. They fined each of them $1,000. One of them they found fined $2,000. They sent us fines as well. In Austin, they've sent us a cease and desist, and the city council has made it possible for the taxi enforcers to impound vehicles as well. And so I think what happened in California is we went from an attitude of the regulators to, hey, you can't do that, we're going to shut you down. Two, oh, okay, wait a minute, we get it. This is a new medium. We need new rules. Let's have a conversation about what this new medium is like, what the right rules should be for it, and how do we benefit California through this new capability. That's the approach we want. We want to talk to these folks. We're not knee-jerk libertarians. We're not saying there's no role for government. We just think that there needs to be a way to encourage innovation rather than thwart it.
And Kristen Faircheck, your company, I believe, reached an agreement with regulators. Mm-hmm. So what was the deal there to get them off your back?
Right. So similar to Sidecar, Lyft has a number of trust and safety components in place, including DMV record checks, background checks, rating system, et cetera. And the Public Utilities Commission's number one concern is really public safety. I think they're not as focused on the entrenched interests like the taxi cabs. They really care about protecting consumers. And so once we were able to show them the various things that we do to protect consumers, we were able to come to a settlement agreement.
But you agreed to that, and that agreement was not acceptable to you.
This agreement we're talking about is basically an agreement to stay the fines and the cease and desist until the rulemaking process is done, at which point all the stuff could basically come back if the rulemaking goes against us. Those conversations we've agreed to keep confidential, and so I'm not going to go into the details. But I will say that we obviously have not agreed to what the PUC proposed. We have some sort of principled disagreements with what they have so far, and we may end up signing it, but only after we get agreement on those principles.
So where's this going? This is innovation is ahead of policy, as often is the case. There's some incumbent industries that are fighting to protect. Susan Shaheen, you know, where's this going to shake out? There'll be some new rules, these new industries, hopefully some jobs created in California, other places. Where's this going?
I think we definitely have to work through these policy issues for the entire shared use mobility space. The folks in the ride sharing space are hitting it first, but I think a lot of questions about liability, insurance, new insurance models, new ways of doing pricing, a lot of things need to be worked out.
Those are all built around ownership, not these kind of
access.
Communal, right?
Yeah, right. They're not based around principles of access. And so I think we really need to work across the industry. So there's many different players in this besides car sharing and ride sharing. I mean, we've got public bike sharing in it. We have new models of fractional ownership that are being developed that fit into this space. So there's a range that could be represented, and collectively, I think they have a voice. But it's difficult when you're an entrepreneur trying to run a business and get it off the ground to work out all of these legal matters and to take them on. So I think we definitely need a new policy framework. We need a new dialogue. And I've seen a lot of promise in regulators wanting to have that dialogue, but it's this immediate reaction that I think is really tough and is very difficult for the small companies, because this could stomp out innovation
by the time rules get made. There's also, you mentioned,
can I just add,
sure, Sunil,
that this is, we're seeing this not just in transportation, we're seeing it in with Airbnb's challenges in sharing. It is across the board. Sharing is not a crime. It is good for society, and we need to figure out a way to encourage sharing innovations, not thwart them.
He has a hashtag. Is it what? The hashtag defending sharing?
Defend sharing hashtag.
Right. There's good access on Twitter on a lot of these things. Sharing economy hashtag. Our handle is.
Oh, we should get people to sign our petition too. We've got a petition to help us with South by Southwest, which is coming up this weekend in Austin. You know, the timing of these actions by Austin is really unfortunate. We were planning on providing these shared rides in Austin for South by Southwest, and along come all these actions. So we would love support on our petition at change.org. You just search on Sidecar, you'll see it.
Liability and insurance was mentioned earlier. I want to reference quickly a case of not a company up here, but Relay Ride had a person, a tragic case where an MIT student and a Googler, Liz Fong Jones, rented out her Honda. The driver was killed. Several people were seriously injured. There's $1 million insurance liability. It looks like that will be exceeded. She could be on the hook financially. This is quite a case of something that no one really thought would happen, but lending out your car is different than Airbnb and sort of leasing out your couch, isn't she?
Well, I would say this echoes right back to the public policy issue, right? Because Sunil talked about his work to develop peer-to-peer car sharing legislation, which would help to protect consumers in a liability situation, as well as protect their rights to make money off of use and access to their car. And, you know, only two other states have adopted that legislation thus far. So in that particular state, Massachusetts, there was no protective legislation in place. So you can see, are these small companies expected to go state by state by state to develop legislation? It's going to be impossible for them to do that. So we need to elevate this to a national dialogue, if not a higher level dialogue as well. And the liability issues, I think, need to be addressed. And if we're only using a vehicle or accessing a vehicle for an hour or for minutes, is the current ownership insurance model the proper model? Probably not. So I think we also need to really start to look at insurance vehicles and, you know, do we need new insurance approaches, new insurance products to help promote shared use?
And will this be market-driven or regulatory-driven? Because in the case of that Relay Ride case, the insurance companies are saying, hey, we've got different clients. They're on different sides, protecting different interests. So it's hard to see the market really doing this. It
seems help us if the regulators are in charge of innovation.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine if the PUC ran Twitter? I mean, I mean, nothing against the PUC people. They're all great
will have to
and
sort it
do
out.
Their job, but the institution is not set up to do that. That's not their job. Their job is to protect public safety, not to encourage innovation. I'm sorry, that's just not their charge. And there has to be a way to... The role of public policy, the role of people is to encourage innovation. The role of our government is to encourage innovation. It has to happen through the marketplace, though.
And you think insurance companies innovate?
Yes. Yes.
They're going to have to. There's in insurance, you've got the commercial side and you have the personal side, and they do not meet. They don't talk the same language even sometimes. And when you have cars involved with different regulatory environments in different states, you have a mess. And so, and right now, as is typical of any business that's been relatively successful over a long period of time, you get inertia, and they're going to do everything they can to protect what works for them.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, it's not working for new mobility. It's not working for as far as promoting and helping innovative new ideas get accomplished at a cost that is practical. In the peer-to-peer car sharing model right now, it's a great model, but one of the key issues that they have is that they cannot make any money with the insurance costs at the level that they're at. I think Sunil can talk about this. I think when he penciled it out, and we penciled it out years ago, we went, great idea. Is it scalable and will it ever make money? And it's not going to make money if insurance regulations, insurance companies don't become more innovative and don't choose to create a new product, quite frankly.
It took a lot of work to get people to be able to take their health insurance different places, like you're talking about taking your auto or mobility insurance different places. That was a long, hard thought.
I do think there's going to be innovation in insurance. You know, there's large companies that may be more resistant given their existing models and practices, but there's smaller insurance companies that may be more nimble and be able to see and pencil out the risk. I mean, car sharing, Rick, you can speak to this. I mean, tremendous history of wonderful safety, good driving records. So there's not a lot of accidents in the shared use space, at least with respect to public bike sharing and car sharing. I know this for a fact. So there's money to be made by the insurance industry by understanding that actuarial data, that risk data.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about car sharing at Climate One. Our guests are Susan Shaheen, co-director of the Transportation Sustainability Research Center at UC Berkeley, Kristen Svercek at Lyft and Zimride, Sunil Paul, CEO of Sidecar, and Rick Hutchinson, CEO of City Car Share. I'm Greg Dalton. Before we go to audience questions, I want to talk about how this is going to affect buildings and cities and the way that we build new spaces, accommodate growth. There's going to be a lot of new people in the Bay Area in coming years, and if we build housing and parking one-to-one, that has implications. Are we going to see situations where there's painted curbs where you get special parking places if you're driving a shared car or shared ride? So how's the land use and urban planning going to connect with mobility as a shared service?
Well, why don't I take that? San Francisco actually has been somewhat innovative in this area. Back in 2006, the planning code was changed so that now in San Francisco, any building, commercial or residential, that is built is required to have car sharing if they have above a certain amount of units. That kind of legislation is being studied and looked at in other venues as well. We did a pilot test on on-street car sharing parking last year with the city of San Francisco. Now, this is a very interesting subject because what we're talking about is using the public right-of-way and the public good and making it available to private companies. So it shouldn't be taken lightly. The fact is that there are many benefits to allowing shared vehicles of any kind to be parked in areas where we might have some equity issues, where car sharing or car ownership is not financially viable. And therefore, being able to have on-street parking or parking that is somehow either subsidized or permitted is going to help expand car sharing, and I believe some of the other models greatly. In the Bay Area, parking is one of the key aspects that creates costs for all, for almost every model, and it's very, very difficult to find in high-demand areas.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else on that, how it's going to change the way we build cities that respond to growth and incorporate?
I think the sharing models have a tremendous opportunity to reduce the infrastructure needs for cities. Mm-hmm. We think about it takes so much money. You know, it costs $1 million a mile to build a sidewalk, not to mention a freeway. It is incredibly expensive to build these things in public infrastructure. And so having shared use, I mean, we already have HOV lanes, having shared use of apartments through an Airbnb-style system, having shared use of roads through a sidecar kind of system, having shared use of public infrastructure for parking spaces through a car sharing, like all of these things make our public dollars go further than they would otherwise. And I think it's fundamental to, especially a money-constrained environment that we are living in for the foreseeable future, sharing has to be part of the solution.
But building developers don't like what they see as a government mandate. You got to put in sharing. Like it messes with their economics.
Well, that's not necessarily true here. There are lots of developers who buy into this. Many developers, at least in the Bay Area, and I can speak best because we're a local community-based organization here, but many developers get this. And they look at sharing as an amenity for their projects. They'll look, they see it as an opportunity also to build less parking. Parking costs $30,000 to $40,000 per space to build. So if you can not build those spaces and put in a few other units or even some open space, that makes a better project. And therefore, many developers have, quite frankly, are very supportive of what we're doing.
We're talking about car sharing at Climate One. We'd like to invite your participation. Don't be shy. Come on up here and come to this microphone. And who's going to be the first brave soul? Again, if you're on this side, we encourage you to come over to that side. And the line starts with our producer, Jane Ann, who will invite you up to invite your question. So while that line is forming, let's talk about the jobs impact. How many people, we talked a little bit about a little extra income, but are these companies significant job creators, job drivers? Let's get a sense of new jobs as well as sort of part-time incremental jobs. Sunil, how many employees does Sidecar have?
Sidecar itself has about 50 employees around the country, but if you look at the kind of little extra income or offsetting of vehicle costs, you know, we're closing in on 1,000 people around the country.
We heard 1 million members of car sharing services. Kristen, how about jobs?
Our numbers are actually pretty similar to Sidecar's. I think we have about 40 to 45 full-time employees at Lyft now, and hundreds more receiving incremental income because of being able to ride share.
Part of the gig economy. Let's have our question. Hi, welcome.
Hi. I'm wondering if any local developments have partnered with the car sharing service and actually marketed that as a benefit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. We have several buildings in San Francisco and also over in the East Bay. There's a local developer who named Patrick Kennedy, who has recently, you maybe have heard of these micro unit developments that are going up. You know,
super small housing.
Super small housing. Well, Patrick has been a leader in that space, and one of the things that he pitched to the city here is, I won't build any parking. I won't build any parking. We'll use car sharing, so we'll have these micro spaces where more people can use either as, you know, pied-à-terres or for specific housing needs.
These are housing that might fit in a parking space,
that's
right?
True. So that's true. And we don't want people living in the car necessarily, but it could be bigger than some of those spaces, yeah.
Okay, so it can be a selling point, still a niche. And Susan Shaheen, anything to add to that?
No, I've been tracking this for a long time, and I see developers really getting on board with this because they can make better use of that space and provide.
But deeded parking is a selling point. When you go into a condo, the idea that owner's like, well, man, what if there's not a place for me to park when I come home with my Christmas tree, whatever? Deeded parking is a selling point versus shared parking. Now this is one step further, right?
Well, in many cities nowadays and locally here, you have unbundled parking. So therefore, a condo that is sold or a rental apartment must separate parking, and you mm-hmm. pay a separate amount for that. So if you choose to go car free, you do not have to pay for that spot or to or even buy it. At least in urban environments, that seems to be more popular. And again, with sharing, with sharing mobility services, that whether you can use sidecar or Lyft and get a car immediately, or be a member of City Car Share and have cars for more common needs, you don't need to have a car in the city.
How about the impact on transit? Is this just taking people off buses, or is this impacting transit in any significant way? People, would they take Muni if they didn't use City Car Share?
Well, this is where model matters. And there are different models of car sharing, ride sharing, and peer-to-peer car sharing. We know through studies that have been done that when people join City Car Share, that they decrease their driving by about 45%, how many miles they drive, and they increase their use of walking, biking, and public transportation by over 50%. We've done studies with BART and the San Francisco MTA over the years to show that we are actually pushing more people onto public transit quite a bit, actually. Locally last year, we had more people taking BART across the bay to use a car share car at a BART station in one area than we had members using it who lived there.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense because BART doesn't go everywhere. If there's a car share there waiting for you to get you that final mile, whatever,
yeah,
makes a lot of sense. Let's have our next question. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for a great panel, by the way, so far. The social value of ride sharing, very impressive. The financial value to the companies in this space seems to be more of a question mark. So we talked about insurance liability for peer-to-peer sharing. Also, if you look at Zipcar's stock performance, it was quite underwhelming until they got bought by Avis Budget for an even more underwhelming price. In fact, it spawned several lawsuits. So my question really is, what can you tell us about how compelling this market is for the companies that are in it financially? And if we had this panel 10 years from now, are these companies still going to be here? Mm-hmm.
Why don't you start with your banking background, and
right,
then I will play in.
Bear with me for a second, but
we should, before you start, distinguish ride sharing from car sharing.
Okay.
Because I think you asked about ride sharing, but
are you asking about ride sharing?
Zipcar was actually about car sharing.
So mostly about ride sharing. So Rick Hutchinson from City Car Share.
Well, as far as car sharing is concerned, now we're a nonprofit, but we've made money for many years, and we take all that money, we put it back in the community through a low-income product we have called Community Share. We developed the first wheelchair-accessible vans in the industry that are shared. We have an EV program going on. We're going to initiate an electric bike program. That's where we take our profits. The point here is that we and several other transit-oriented car-sharing companies are making money, and not a lot, but enough to create some social programs that we think are important and to help expand car sharing. Mm-hmm. Ride sharing, new model here. I think my opinion is that people like Sunil would not be in it if there wasn't some money that was going to be made somewhere down the line, as well as some social good that was produced.
And Sunil Paul, Google Ventures is, I think, investor in Sidecar, so they're doing it for money too. So
that's right. So we've raised a venture round, as well as a number of angel investors. Lightspeed and Google Ventures are the two sort of institutional investors in it. And this is my third company that I've started and run, and invested in many. And the last company was very successful. I've made a lot of money already. So I am a capitalist, so I certainly expect to make money on this company, and it's a big reason why I did this. But I'm doing this company not just because I think I can make money, but because I think I can make a big difference and I can make history. I sincerely believe that there's an opportunity to build a big company that fundamentally changes transportation, and that 10 years from now we'll look back and say, wow, yeah, that, not just Sidecar, but other companies in this space, ended up transforming the way we think about transportation. In the same way that we look back on the early days of electronic commerce And we say, wow, okay, Amazon, they weren't just selling books. And eBay, they weren't just handling collectibles and allowing people to trade collectibles. There's a whole bit of commerce has changed because of those companies. So I think we're in a similar stage with transportation. I think that the smartphone is going to unlock mobility in a different way. It's not just your mobile phone. It's going to be your mobility phone.
So you may never buy a car for that young child that you mentioned that when they grow up and they hit 16 like you and I wanted so bad. It's like may not happen.
You know, the trend's already headed downward. The number of people who get driver's licenses at age, I think it's under 21, that population has been declining really since the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And it's in part because of the phone for a different reason. In the past, the automobile was your key to freedom, your literal key to freedom. You got those keys, and now you could go out and do stuff in the world. But today, you know, my almost 12-year-olds, they've got freedom already. They can talk to their friends. They can have a social life. They don't have to be stuck with their dad all the time because they've got a smartphone. So that kind of, it's already unlocking a different kind of freedom and mobility. And I think that even when you take it to the point of, oh, okay, I really do need to be able to move around in a city, and I really do need to be able to get groceries, mm-hmm. and I really do need to be able to get to a job, all those things will be possible for my kids through their phone.
Would you call up a rideshare, sidecar, or Lyft, or Uber, and put those kids in a car and send them somewhere?
Sidecar, absolutely. Actually, not quite yet. They're only 11 and a half. Certainly, when they're older, I absolutely would.
Yeah, I've thought about it. Let's have our next audience question.
Hi. Sunil, you said you've been talking about this or thinking about it for 10-plus years. Based on stuff that's floating around in the last few weeks, 10-plus years, they're saying that we'll have self-driving cars. How mm-hmm. do you think the model changes
absolutely.
When self-driving cars become a reality?
Another reason why I jumped in is self-driving cars. One of the reasons we're attracted to Google Ventures as an investor is self-driving cars. We think that it is a fundamental change to transportation that will occur, and that having a community and a network where you can get access to a ride plays very well to self-driving cars.
And I would just add that many people in the industry are arguing that really good platforms for testing autonomous vehicles are actually shared-use fleets.
And so, yeah, the idea of buying a self-driving car might be a little scary, but going to city car share or Zipcar or something like that, which can also be a factor for EVs, people who are interested in electric vehicles, mm-hmm. maybe they don't want to buy mm-hmm. because of range anxiety, et cetera. But that could be a good place to sort of prime the market for electric vehicles.
Well,
Rick Atkinson.
We have a large program going with electric vehicles, and currently we only have 20 vehicles in our fleet. We'll double it this year. But one of the interesting facts is that in the first 6 months that we had our initial 10 vehicles out in our fleet, plug-ins, some of them are plug-in electric vehicles, some of them are full electric vehicles, we had over 3,000 unique individuals try those cars. That's more people who tried an electric vehicle through our fleet than were sold in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
So we think car sharing and city car sharing in particular, we're also putting in charging stations, some for public use, some for car share use in locations that will allow us to do it.
Do you know if any of those triers went on to become buyers?
We suspect that we've had some short-term memberships that we're looking to try out various vehicles, and we're happy to be used that way as well.
We've actually found in our car sharing research that individuals who have a life change, for instance, they need to move to the suburbs or they have a child or something like that, they often buy a vehicle that they were commonly driving in car sharing.
And you mentioned,
I think this is a common, this whole idea of sharing and variety, it's intrinsic to the whole sharing experience.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you are One of the things that's attractive about using someone else's apartment when you're visiting is that you get to connect. It's variety. It's not the same old Holiday Inn. One of the things about car sharing is that you get to try different vehicles. One of the things about, you know, sidecars, you get to meet all these interesting people and different vehicles. It's part of what makes it a fun experience. It's not just, oh, okay, I'm used to it. It's the same old thing every day, every day.
Yeah, when I was a member of City Car Share, I drove some of those, what, Cyan, the square boxy things. Yeah. I'd never buy one, but I felt cool and hip for like driving those things around. You mentioned the suburbs. Does this model translate to suburban or rural America, or is this something that's really a metropolitan area? The Ford F-150 is the largest best-selling truck car in America, and that gives you a sense of where a lot of the buyers and drivers are. So Susan Shaheen, does this move out to the suburbs?
I believe it will. I think the stronghold for these systems will be urban areas just because of density patterns and how people are going to be gravitating more and more towards urban living. But I do think through phenomenon like peer-to-peer car sharing, dynamic ride sharing, fractional ownership, which is the idea that several people co-own a vehicle, and all this connectivity that's provided through these mobile devices and applications, there's really not a reason why these things can't spread to other areas. And I think this is sort of the next great challenge for the shared use space, is can we move this into other locations than just these urban areas where we know they will be successful?
Let's have our next question. Welcome.
Yeah, hello. Did you do some research or benchmark on what's happening in Europe on the ride sharing or car sharing space, especially ride sharing? For example, you have two companies. One in Germany, carpooling, they have millions of users. One in France called BlaBlaCar, 3 million of users. Did you check a little bit on why it's so big there and what you can learn from them in the US?
Sunil Paul or Sunil Jaheen?
Do you have any comments on it? In fact, I don't know if he's here. The CEO of carpooling.com was here earlier. They have had tremendous success. They've got all over Europe.
It's a denser population.
Public transportation is better. People are more connected in certain areas.
And gasoline's more expensive.
And they also have institutional and governmental support. And I don't mean financial support. I'm talking about regulatory and policy support. Mm-hmm. And that helps tremendously in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great example of regulation
success.
and the sort of public framework encouraging these kinds of innovations. And it's resulted in, I guess I shouldn't use the number since I don't know if it was confidential, but carpooling.com has done millions and millions of rides. They are doing very, very well. And they're typically doing long distance trips between cities.
Right.
Something similar to Zimride, which Lyft is also involved in, and that started out of colleges. But I saw one today for someone going to Greenbuild in Philadelphia from San Francisco. Is that something that you see is really growing?
Yeah, that's right. So the company Zimride started actually today is our 6-year anniversary of incorporation. Funnily enough, started initially focused on colleges and universities. A really critical thing. With respect to carpooling is getting a critical mass, so a large enough user base. And so the original model of the company was focused around colleges and universities where you have, kind of a dense population of people that are often going to and from the same destinations. Mm-hmm. And Lyft was sort of the natural evolution of that with mobile technology, the ability to do these things in real time rather than planned, a week or so in advance.
We have to end it there. We've been talking about car sharing and ride sharing at Climate One. Our guests have been Kristen Svercek, head of public policy at Lyft and Zimride, Susan Shaheen, co-director of the Transportation Sustainability Research Center at UC Berkeley, Sunil Paul, CEO of Sidecar, a ride sharing company, and Rick Hutchinson, CEO of City Car Share in San Francisco. I'm Greg Dalton. Thank you all for coming to Climate One today.